For too long, the fertility market has been bewildering, overwhelming, and frankly, I think has downright ignored the needs and difficult experiences of the people they're supposed to be serving. Ovum has made it their mission to change this completely. Now, I am extremely choosy about who I promote on this podcast because I'm very protective of my listeners and audience, which is why you've probably only ever heard one spoken ad like this before. So it's with complete confidence, excitement, and pride that I can share this amazing company with you. Ovum care about you, truly. From creating products to support conception and fertility that are designed by doctors and backed by the latest science without cutting any corners, from adding access to meditations I've personally written and recorded inside their pregnancy test boxes, Ovum is founded by individuals who've navigated infertility themselves. I really couldn't be more proud to partner with them and tell you about them. Ovum is driven by the belief that everyone who is trying to conceive deserves better, and I am 100% behind this ethos. So head over to startwithovum.com and use code LIFERAFT10 for 10% off their tests and supplements. Welcome to the Fertility Life Raft with me, Alice Rose. I am your mindset mentor and transformative coach. It's an honor to have you. I'm chatting with the lovely Dr. Shimi. No, we're not going to call you doctor on this one,
no.
Are we?
No.
Doctor in this capacity. No. You're just lovely, Shima. And I've known you now for years, actually, like since I kind of discovered the Instagram fertility scene. But this is the first time we've had a proper long chat, and I'm really, really looking forward to it. So there are lots of reasons, actually, why I wanted to invite you on here. But if you wouldn't mind, please do share a little bit about how you ended up chatting about fertility and about loss as well.
Thanks, Alice. I think I'm one of the proper old guard on fertility Insta. I joined in 2016, January 2016, really, because at that time I was about to have my fourth cycle of IVF and I had gone through it totally alone. I found it so challenging to talk to people, really carried a lot of shame and stigma around infertility. And so I started an anonymous Instagram account, really thinking I'm just going to document what I'm doing every day just for me. And all it was photos of the medication I was taking, the injections. And I think I had about 5 followers. I didn't really post much. And then my fourth cycle, I got pregnant and it was the first time I'd been pregnant. So prior to that, 3 cycles of IVF, first 2 cycles, I didn't really produce any eggs. I was told that I would never produce good enough eggs and that I had less than 1% chance of conceiving with my own eggs. And I had a really lovely doctor who was in tears as she was telling me this, saying, you know, we could try another cycle on the NHS, but really your only option now is donor eggs. So she was crying and I was consoling her because I actually am very pragmatic. So I was like, well, if that's what it's going to take, that's what I have to do. So I realised for lots of people that shift into donor egg conception is a big deal. For me, that was never a big thing in my journey. It was like, right, if that's what it takes to become a parent, I'm not totally, for me, mothering isn't about genetics. I don't need to have a genetic connection to a child to feel like I am their parent. So yeah, fourth cycle, we'd gone into a donor egg cycle and I was finally pregnant. But very quickly, things started to unravel. So not only was I very anxious about my pregnancy, as many people are when they finally conceive after IVF, like all pregnancies are precious, but there's something about IVF pregnancies. They're just the heightened anxiety and emotion. So I was anxious. And then I was in the first few scans, it looked like I was going to miscarry very early. And I started being very open on Instagram at that point, just because I had nowhere else to go with all this stuff. And that was really helpful because I had other women reach out to me and they were really sort of supporting me. And as that pregnancy unfolded, more and more complications came up and I made it to 21 weeks. But sadly, at 21 weeks, I lost our baby because my waters broke at 21 weeks and there was nothing they could do to save him. So my son, Altair, was stillborn in June 2017. And at that point, I was just, you know, it was like watching a film of my life. It's something you don't believe will ever happen to you, having to sort of deliver your baby, knowing that they're not going to survive. All of it was just like beyond any frame of reference. And I was just on Instagram in real time talking about what was happening, not because I wanted to raise awareness or destigmatize anything, but because I was in so much pain and I didn't know where to go, because I still hadn't told a lot of people I know that I was going through IVF or that I was pregnant. And there was an outpouring of love and support through Instagram, through those tiny little squares. And this is like 2017, before fertility Instagram is what it is now. Mm-hmm. After that, there were five women in particular who I'm going to shout out to, the Pineapple Queens, who got in touch with me after we lost Altair, and they sent stuff. They sent flowers and jewelry. They'd never met me before. Mm. They just reached out, and a couple of months later, we arranged to meet. We all at that point were living near London or in London. We arranged to meet, and I mean, they've become my best friends now. I mean, like in real life.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah,
it's a gift, isn't it? It's like one of those gifts that I'm not someone who thinks that you need to look for silver linings. I don't believe in that kind of crap. But I see that as a gift from Altair, is that, you know, we lost him, but what he did was bring these incredible women into my life who I now speak to every day. They're just really close friends. So between them and Instagram, I had the support to be much more public about my infertility journey after that, also about baby loss. Had a couple of more cycles of IVF, sixth cycle of IVF, got pregnant again. By this stage, was on lots of medication to keep the pregnancy because I'd been diagnosed with a rare condition of my placenta. My son, Faris, was born December 2018. He's just started school. So he's about to turn five, which just feels unreal. And then I had this sort of final twist in the tail, which is like the most bonkers part of this journey. Having been told that I would never conceive naturally, having needed to have donor egg conception, six cycles of IVF, very high risk pregnancies, all heavily medicated. There I was at sort of 7 months with a 7 month old baby, breastfeeding. I was 43. I'd had quite severe postnatal depression. So I was not in a good place mentally. I think my husband and I must have had sex once and I got pregnant, which you could not, if you scripted it, you would think that's so far fetched. So August 2019, I started feeling tired, sick. I hadn't had a period for ages, but I thought, well, I'm getting older and also I'm breastfeeding. And then I still wasn't feeling well, took a pregnancy test. It was positive. We could not believe it. And it turned out at that time I was 7 weeks pregnant. So I must have conceived Lyra when Faris was 6 months old. And I was terrified because I had barely coped with having one baby and suddenly I was going to have another baby. And going through another very high risk pregnancy, lots of scans, lots of medication. She was born 1st of April 2020, end of the first week of the first lockdown.
Thank you so much for sharing all of your dramatic path to parenthood. Yeah. And for sharing Altair with us, who, you know, I've known of him now this whole time as well. And it's just, and that's a really beautiful thing, I think, that that we know his name and that we talk about that, and that I know that you have three children. Like, it's just how I really understand that to be true. Yeah. You know, there's something as I wanted to ask around. I wonder what it is that draws us to share like that. Like, before the fertility community, like it is now, kind of existed, what is it that kind of, I know you were saying, like, it's, I didn't know anywhere else to go, but something drew you to thinking, right, I'm going to just document what's going on here. What was it that made you do that, do you think?
Yeah, I have reflected on it because I was thinking, how else could I have got through that time? Well, I could have gone to support groups, but I didn't really know of many fertility support groups at that time. At that time, in terms of social media, there was Twitter. I mean, how much are you going to say in like a sentence about something so complicated?
Yeah.
And Twitter's always been a little bit toxic. Facebook, yeah, there were probably Facebook closed groups. I don't know, there was something about Instagram. It was open, anonymous. I really liked the sort of visual element of it. For me, what worked was that there was no intention. It just happened organically. I went on there thinking this will be a way of just documenting what's happened. And then it morphed into just this tremendous source of support. And we all know when we go through infertility, there's nothing like speaking to somebody else who's going through it or has been through it, because other people just don't get it. They just don't understand. And I was angry for a lot of that time. I was just too angry to speak. I've got lovely friends, but most of them had children. And I was angry. I was angry with them, at them, at the world.
At the situation, right?
Yeah.
That's the thing that's difficult to differentiate sometimes. It's like, I'm angry. It's not that you probably weren't angry at your friends. You were angry at the situation that you found yourself. And the fact that, you know, there was so much that was going on, but no proper support that you knew of available. But the fact that you found your pineapple queens brings me so much joy. I love hearing stories like that.
Yeah. I mean, that was amazing. And but also at that time, there weren't, you know, all these amazing books that are around now about infertility and about baby loss. None of them were around. No one was writing and no one was talking about it publicly.
Yes.
Either infertility or baby loss. So there was nowhere to go to read other people's stories. I think the only thing that I found at the time that was incredible for me was Elle Wright, Feathering the Empty Nest. After we lost Altair, I found her account, and I really remember clearly reading a post of hers where she'd lost her son, I think a year earlier. I was at like the depths of like the lowest point I've ever been. And she posted something about just having an ordinary day where she'd gone to the beach and had fish and chips and she was happy. It made such a huge difference to me, because I thought, oh my God, she has lost, her baby has died. But she's telling us that, you know, 12 months down the line, you can still feel that ordinary happiness, like not, you know, big feelings, just going for a walk on a beach and enjoying it. Because at that time, that felt like that would never happen for me. That's why these stories matter. And at the time, the only place those stories were being shared was on Instagram.
Shout out to Elle. I mean, she's just, you know, been a real leader, really, wasn't she, in moving the conversations forward. She's been on this podcast. She's such a generous person as well, with like supporting other people. So just, if you haven't found her, Feathering the Emptiness, wonderful, wonderful Elle, who's written her book, Ask Me His Name, which is just gorgeous. And she's done other things as well, hasn't she? But yes, it's that kind of thing about that it wasn't being spoken about anywhere. And now, leading me on to this thing that I really wanted to speak to you about, is that now it is spoken kind of everywhere, actually. So fertility really had quite the moment, I think, you know, and coming out into the, you know, Instagram really kind of blew up. A lot of people sort of coming out and sharing their stories, loads of celebrity stories. It's becoming really normal to talk about it. And actually, we have an increased fertility issue, or we, you know, looking at the reasons why it might be happening, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the thing that I have an issue with is that now that it is out there, it's almost kind of a fertility in the mainstream, and the way that it is spoken about, I find troublesome. And I find it particularly troublesome because I have actually worked on trying to get fertility in the mainstream media spoken about properly after I got a whole week of fertility content onto Radio 2, which was, you know, such a passion of mine to try and make sure it was got onto the biggest network, you know, the biggest platform I could have any kind of ability to get this conversation out onto in the UK. And we got it on there and it was great. And, you know, I was their communications consultant, and, you know, I really did work incredibly hard to try to make sure all the conversations that were had on this mainstream platform were sensible, and that kind of took into account the actual patient experience. And that took some serious effort to try to get these people who work in such a huge platform to listen to what we wanted to say. The issue is that...
I know where you're going with this.
Yeah. So the issue is that, you know, that was a sort of sustained little period of time. That was a project that was for 1 week. And, you know, I'm only one person. But what then has obviously happened is that it's kind of snowballed. It's been everywhere. It's lots of mainstream conversations. And we've lost, really, I think, a lot of the real heart of understanding. And what made me really think, right, I'm going to get Shima on the podcast to talk about this, was that we had this recent story, didn't we, that came out, and the BBC covered it, and it was to do with this quite difficult piece of research, I'm saying research like this because I just think it's a bit problematic, but essentially said that one in five women will have a natural pregnancy after having an IVF baby. Mm. And this kind of really kind of blew up actually when it was all over the media. And I remember thinking, interesting, because it happened to me. And yet I know that it's actually a really nuanced and layered story. So I was interested to see, like, how's the mainstream media going to report this? And then I heard you on Radio 2 talking to Jeremy Vine, and he said to you, do you think it's because you weren't stressed anymore and you'd already had your baby? Do you think that's why you got pregnant? And I just wanted to scream because I was like, oh, for God's sake, Jeremy.
I mean, I just found it remarkable. And I thought only a man could say that you must have been relaxed with a 6-month-old baby. I had a very, very robust response and kind of shut that conversation down and said to him, I had a 6-month-old baby and I was recovering from postnatal depression. I was probably the most stressed and the most exhausted I have ever been in my life. This was not a case of me having relaxed and this just happened. This is a case of us not understanding conception and infertility. And it is not a sort of binary thing. It's not for those of us who still have our tubes intact. It's not a binary, you can't get pregnant or you can get pregnant. It's a much grayer area. I can categorically say that I wasn't relaxed. That is not what happened. I did respond robustly. I did think that, so I know the researcher who did that piece of work. I think it's a really great piece of research, and it's an important thing that we needed to talk about because women do need to be able to plan their pregnancies. And I think there's an assumption that I had as a doctor that I could not get pregnant. And if I'd known those statistics, I perhaps would have been a bit more careful. What was lost in the media was the nuances about it depends what the cause of your infertility is. Because clearly, if you don't have any fallopian tubes, this is not going to happen. It's those of us who've been lucky enough to retain our tubes. And what the media didn't pick up on is that, yes, one in five women may conceive naturally after IVF, but the majority won't. And yeah, the media wants a nice, happy story, don't they? They want the, you know, this is great, rather than the majority of women will still need to have IVF.
And that's it. And, you know, and I did a piece for The Telegraph about this as well, because because it was a story that was kind of really started to become interesting and people really wanted to get to the bottom of it. But again, it kind of was lost in the article that came out. I was like, No, not the pieces are not joining up. And this is the issue, isn't it? It's like those of us who have actually experienced fertility really do get it to a level that really is very difficult, actually, it seems, to portray in any other way. And that, I think, exactly as you say, it's grey. It's not a kind of you can or you can't. And that's what I did not understand when I came into the world of fertility. I just kind of thought, well, either you can conceive or you can't. I really didn't understand that there were so many other factors at play that we don't really get and that haven't been researched enough, right?
Yeah, there's so much we need to learn about fertility and also about pregnancy and things like pregnancy immune systems and all that kind of stuff. But I do think it's about those of us who've lived this, we are able to face the dark side of it, the sadness, the disappointment, the hopelessness. We've been through that. The thing is, people from the outside don't want to sit with those uncomfortable feelings. So they want to say, you know, we've all had it, you know, oh, you know, if you just go on holiday, you might conceive. Or people want to gloss over it because they can't sit with those difficult feelings. We've had no choice but to sit with those difficult feelings. So we're able to face them head on. Mm-hmm. I think that's partly what underlies the sort of media wanting to pick up the good stories.
Yeah, and it's just that they don't really have the capacity really to like really dive into it. And that's why you do need specialist fertility conversations
where, yeah, absolutely,
those of us who get it and who have actually been talking about this for years really understand like all of the how it will be received. And that's the thing, like when you see fertility in the media. And there was something on Woman's Hour as well that the infertile midwife Sophie commented on and was just rolling her eyes, being like, no, no, no. Did you see that? It was around.
Didn't see it.
They basically had a conversation where they were talking about, oh, you know, there's so much fertility conversations now that actually people are getting really scared about their fertility. And then I just got pregnant really quickly, and that was really scary for me. And we were a bit like, I don't.
I heard that. Yes, I did hear that. And as a doctor, I found it really uncomfortable because I was saying, are you saying that we shouldn't tell women that actually your fertility does decline as you get older? Because you need to have sensible evidence-based information. It was almost like, you can't tell people this.
Yeah, because you'll scare people. And then, you know, and it's not that. It's, I think you really have to understand that, like, we do need to normalize the conversations, and people have to be educated. And at the same time, give hope that, not that, you know, it's going to work for everyone or anything like that, but hope that there absolutely is a way through it that is supportive, and that there are people who really do know what they're talking about that can support you through it. So you can kind of drop your shoulders and just think, okay, let's take in the information that's being shared, because it's got to be shared, and we need to face up to this. But let's not punish the people who are talking about it by saying, you know, you're scaring us, stop talking about it.
We need knowledge. I mean, knowledge is power. Without that, you can't make informed decisions about your future. And I really believe passionately in empowering men and women and people who are non-binary with this, you know, information when they're young, so they know, so it isn't a surprise when they're in their 30s, because, you know, your fertility doesn't fall off a cliff. It is a gradual decline, but there is a decline, and we can't pretend that that doesn't happen. Sad and disappointing, and many of us feel young in our 40s, but it's a fact, and we all need to know that.
Yeah,
not talk about it.
Exactly. And it's actually, I again, it's just that knowledge is power, because actually, if you are a bit more conscious about this in your 20s, and you think, okay, let's learn a little bit about what can impact fertility, what can I do to and it might be that you're absolutely fine. You know, if anyone's listening to this and they haven't gone down, they actually just are trying to get information, you might be fine. But at the same time, it's really, really important to know what might happen and what to do about it if you do end up going through these things. And hopefully the fact that we have kind of really led a bit of a charge here, like in terms of changing the conversations and shifting the social narratives around it, it will be better for future generations. That's what we hope.
I hope so. I don't feel like IVF, like infertility and having fertility treatment, whatever that treatment is, I don't feel it carries the same stigma that it did when I started, you know, in 2015, 2016. I felt like there was a sense of blaming me, and other people would blame me for this. I think we're having much more nuanced conversations now, and I think people do feel empowered to just say, this is what's happening. And I feel proud if I've been a small part of that, and for other people who've also led that charge to just have these conversations very openly and say, this is what infertility looks like. It can happen to anyone. There's no blame attached. It's a medical condition. It's like, you know, anything else. We don't have to be ashamed about it.
Yes, 100%. And that is so transformative when we kind of release that shame and we just talk about it like it's a medical condition. Just quickly, I know that you have... I mean, there's so much more that I want to talk to you about, but I'm going to keep it succinct. There's two things. Number one, how do you feel your role as a doctor? I mean, you're a clinical research fellow. You've got a very grown-up job. How does your sort of doctor mind, like, how does that tally with going through something like this? Do you think it helped you process information, or how does that impact your experience?
It definitely helps. I'm not sure that's the case for all doctors and nurses and midwives, but for me, definitely it helped. It meant I was able to just sift through information very quickly. I was able to assess what information I trusted, what I didn't trust. I didn't find the physical process of going through IVF very difficult, because I'm not fussed about injections, medications, scans, doctors. I'm the most comfortable when I'm around doctors. That's like my natural environment, and I just kind of thrive on it. So none of that fazed me, which I think it would have done if I wasn't a medic. And also, when we lost Altair, when we had his post-mortem result, I'd been told not to worry about what they'd found in my placenta. And luckily, because I'm a clinician and a researcher, I'd read the report and thought, no, I don't believe them. And I'd gone back and pulled out loads of papers. and basically became like the world's leading expert on my condition in 24 hours and was able to email all the world's leading experts and get the right professor looking after me on the right treatment. Without that, I almost certainly would have had recurrent stillbirth.
Wow.
That's where being a doctor and having the knowledge, but also, I guess, the privilege and power to be able to just immediately get on the phone to other doctors and say, look, can you help me? It made a massive difference. And I think that's what's really fueled my passion to try and address those kind of inequities. I strongly believe that the reason I have Faris and Lyra now is partly because I'm a doctor and I was able to be empowered enough to get the right care and not believe what people were saying to me. That worries me about other women, because it shouldn't be down to the fact that I have that power and privilege.
Wow, I'm like blown away by that. That's huge, isn't it? And yeah. You're absolutely right. I mean, I remember like having my first, here you go, here are your injections, and having a total breakdown at home, because I was like, I don't know how to do it. And I think it's got a little bubble and is that okay? I don't know. And it's just like everything, the stakes are so high. And when it's not your natural habitat at all, it can feel so difficult. And the fact that you were, gosh, that's amazing. This fuels your passion, doesn't it, for really working with Tommies. You're a trustee of yeah. the charity Tommies, and they're doing incredible work, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I'm so proud to be a trustee of Tommy. So I joined the board of trustees in 2020. And for me, this is the biggest legacy for Altair. I've kind of left the sort of infertility baby loss community behind a bit on Instagram, because I do feel like I'm now in a different stage of my life, but my activism is still very strong, and I express it through the work that I do with Tommies. So Tommies is, for anyone who doesn't know, is the UK's leading charity that funds research into pregnancy and baby loss. They have done a lot of work on miscarriage, on stillbirth, and also on preterm delivery. We have 5 national research centres that are funded through Tommies. My children are here because of Tommy's research. So the work that Prof Heasel does at the National Stillbirth Research Centre up in Manchester, his research led to the medication combination that saved both my babies' lives. They wouldn't be here without Tommy's research. So I have a very personal connection to Tommy's. We were at a trustee meeting earlier this week, and we had one of the amazing directors of the National Miscarriage Centre, Professor Ari Kiarostami from the University of Birmingham, who presented the frankly incredible work that they've been doing at the National Miscarriage Research Centre. So the use of progesterone in early pregnancy, if women have bleeding in early pregnancy, that's their research. That's Tommy's funded research led by that research centre. And that's saving thousands and thousands of babies' lives. The work around sleeping on, I can never remember, whatever side you're meant to sleep on when you're pregnant.
The left side, isn't it? I feel like it's the left side.
God, I should know that. So sleeping your left side, that's the Manchester team's work. Tommy's research is having huge impact. It's changing lives. We've just developed our new 5-year strategy, where at the heart of our strategy is to address health inequities. So to ensure that pregnancy is safe for all families. I couldn't be prouder. I think it's amazing. And I'm so lucky to have the opportunity to sit on the board and to take that grief and that experience I've had, and to also merge it with my own research and clinical experience, and be able to affect sort of strategy at that sort of national level. Such a privilege, and it's beyond what I could have expected when I lost our baby in June 2017. It's, you know, for me, it's amazing. So yeah, very, very proud to be a trustee of Tommy's.
Incredible work. And you know, sending so much love anyway to everyone who's listening to this who's been affected by loss. And there's Baby Loss Awareness Week coming up here in the UK, which is the beginning of October, and they're doing their Plum and Ashby candle. If anyone wants to support that, it's like 100% of their profits go to Tommy's. That's a really lovely way to support them, and there are so many things that they do that you can go and support their work.
Yeah, at the moment, the other thing you can do is we've got our first ever Walk for Hope, which is in Battersea Park. So there's still space to, I feel like I'm advertising, but it's okay.
No, but do it. Yeah, people will want to know about this.
Sponsored walk, Walk for Hope. It's a fairly gentle walk. I think it's only 5K. Whether you've prepared or not, you can do it, you know, as a family. But it's to raise money for Tommy's. And it's the first time that Tommy's has had this sort of in-person collective walk, because a lot of the events are usually marathons, which take a lot of physical strength, which I don't have. So, yeah, loads of ways to get involved with Tommy's. And buy the candle, if not for any other reason. It just smells amazing. It's like, it's actually really lovely.
Exactly.
When it comes to us.
Oh, it's been so brilliant chatting to you. A huge, huge, huge thank you for everything that you do with Tommy's, for sharing your story. You know, I know that you're in a different season now, but, you know, what you've done and your contribution to moving conversations forward is massive, actually. So a big thank you to you. And for
thanks, Alice. Thank you so much.
Oh, and hang on, how can people find you? You're 1_in_7, aren't you, on Instagram?
Yes, I am. I'm keeping that, even though I've sort of changed the account has changed slightly. I'm keeping that.
1 in 7.
Attachment to that now.
Yeah. That's how
come and find me.
On Instagram. Yeah, amazing. All right, guys. Oh, and I should say, I keep forgetting to say this. Please do rate and review and subscribe this show. You know, that's how people find our podcast, and we will send you, you know, loads of good karma if you take a second now and just go and rate and review the show. I would be so grateful. And share it far and wide, because these conversations can really support lots and lots of people in navigating really, really difficult times of their lives. And please do go and have a look at everything on the website, which is fertilityliferaft.com, and follow us at Fertility Life Raft.